Starting about 10 years ago, TiVo changed the way that many people watch television. Now about one-third of American households can pause their live TVs, record multiple shows at once, and skip through commercials. TiVo wants to change TV watching again by selling a box that would draw video from cable, broadcast, internet streams, and downloads all in one place. Nate DeMeo reports.
You know House, the TV show, Cranky Doctor? Well, you can watch House a ton of different ways. You can watch it live.
28-year-old female, sudden unexplained coagulopathy.
Congenital thrombocytopenia.
Platelets look normal.
You can record it.
28-year-old female, sudden unexplained coagulopathy.
You can stream it or download it onto your computer. And you can watch all of that House right in your own house on your own TV. If you're tech-savvy enough and wealthy enough and patient enough and good enough at keeping lots of wires and remote control straight. Or, says TiVo's Joe Miller, you can buy a TiVo Premiere.
Your TiVo would find you House that's on broadcast, House if it's in syndication, all of the past seasons that might be on Amazon or might be on other services.
And he says it'll find any House that's on YouTube or let you listen to the House soundtrack through a music service. And it will play it all on your TV with one box and one set of wires and one remote.
Think of it as kind of the Google of television.
Which is, of course, a big claim. But whether this particular product can deliver on it or not, the two companies do share a distinction. Like Google, TiVo not only gave the world a new technology, it also gave it a new verb. As in, did you catch Idol last night? No, I TiVo'd it. But unlike Googling, the vast majority of TiVoing doesn't occur while using an actual TiVo. And that's a problem for the company. James McQuivey is an analyst at Forrester Research. He says there are about 1.5 million TiVo brand digital video recorders in American living rooms right now.
There are, meanwhile, another 30 million people in the U.S. who have some kind of DVR, and that's a hard reality for TiVo to face when they essentially invented the category.
People love DVRs. They love being able to pause and rewind live TV, zip through commercials. And ever since the cable and satellite companies started making their own boxes, McQuivey says TiVo has found it hard to find new customers.
A basic DVR made by a cable company or offered by a cable company is so much better than what you have when you don't have any DVR at all. You know, it's a little bit like making it just outside the gates of heaven, and it's so pleasant and warm that you don't realize that just a couple steps away, there's even a better experience to be had.
He says TiVo's new product faces new challenges. The current video landscape is intimidating. There are already so many gadgets that do parts of what TiVo's new one is promising to do. You could buy a Roku or a Vudu or a Sling box or any number of other boxes. Even if the TiVo Premiere is the one gadget to rule them all, Lord of the Rings style, he says it's expensive and daunting all on its own.
If they're going to solve all of your video problems, it means it's going to be, by definition, hard to install. So there's a big upfront hurdle of price and hassle.
Which may be a lot to ask people to do when the whole point of the thing is to eliminate hassles. Even if the TiVo Premiere is the Google of TV, it may be hard to convince people that there isn't a better box coming just down the road. In fact, Google is supposedly working on a set-top box of its own, which just might be the Google of TV. For NPR News, I'm Nate DeMeo.
They're known as flash mobs, gatherings of young people who use social media and texting to publicize a spontaneous group dancing at a train station or get a big crowd together to imitate statues in a park. But in Philadelphia, flash mobs have turned violent. And Susan Phillips of member station WHYY reports the police are cracking down.
South Street is a popular hangout for kids and tourists. 2 weeks ago, pizza shop owner Joey Rocco was finally getting some decent business after a long, snow-packed winter.
Saturday night, we had the windows open. It was a beautiful night. People were sitting in the windows areas. I just happened to look out and I said, wow, the street is really crowded.
Some say the crowd was in the hundreds. Others say thousands. Rocco says the kids began to jump up and down, and then utter chaos broke out. He says some of the teens started beating each other up, while others began banging on the windows of his shop.
They were trying to climb into the windows on top of the people who were dining in the area. So we pushed them out and closed the doors, and then I locked the front doors. So whatever they had in mind, to me, it was like a home invasion.
And it wasn't the first violent flash mob for Philadelphia this year. Two other incidents had kids pushing down pedestrians outside City Hall and pouring into Macy's department store, where they tore merchandise off the shelves. Of the 30 kids picked up and charged in those earlier incidents, 29 got hit with felony convictions. After the third incident, Mayor Nutter stood with a phalanx of police near South Street and warned parents to get better control of their kids or face their own charges.
Parents have a responsibility here, so we will do all that we can. But I ran for mayor. I didn't run for mother. So, you know, I can't take care of everybody's child.
Nutter says he will extend the curfew if the flash mobs continue. One state lawmaker wants to bring back the mounted patrols, and police have created a special rapid response force. Acting on tips, officers converged on several areas after the last incident, but found no flash mobsters. Police were out in force on South Street last weekend, which ended up being a lot colder than the week before. The city's new district attorney, Seth Williams, took a walk down the popular shopping street with neighborhood leaders. Merchants, parents, and police are scratching their heads, trying to explain the explosion of violent flash mobs. So how does it all happen? Williams says it comes down to the proliferation of computers and cell phones.
And the messages get spread geometrically, you know, exponentially, where before it was just, you know, you told somebody to meet you somewhere, or if there was a fight, you'd meet them at the schoolyard. Well, now, instead of just 10 or 20 kids maybe at most knowing about something, you've got 1,000 kids showing up at an intersection, and that's a problem that we as law enforcement have to try to deal with.
15-year-old Benjamin Hamilton says he's never participated in a flash mob, but he knows kids who have.
They talk about them like it's a game or like it's like just a night of fun, and really it's not, because like it's really affecting people in ways that they can't imagine. They might be affecting somebody who might get injured or might get hurt or might get emotionally hurt.
Hamilton says kids he knows dismiss the crackdown and the increased curfew. Some teens spoke out on a local radio show about the incidents, but after one was targeted as a snitch, he was too fearful to speak. The kids said the flash mobs were organized by party groups, and some speculate that gang members took advantage of the chaos. It's been more than a week since the most recent violent flash mob sprung up, but police are concerned about this weekend, where temperatures are expected to be in the 70s. For NPR News, I'm Susan Phillips in Philadelphia.
Weekend edition from NPR News. I beg your pardon. I'm Scott Simon. Apple is releasing its highly anticipated tablet computer today, the iPad. Bet you've heard about that. The sleek device has a 9.7-inch touchscreen and no keyboard. The iPad will offer access to all the usual entertainment available from iTunes, music, movies, TV, but for the iPad, Apple has added books to its offerings. As NPR's Laura Seidel reports, the iPad may boost the burgeoning market for self-publishing.
Writer Mark Morford was a shoo-in for a book contract with a major publishing house. He has 50,000 readers for his provocative column for the San Francisco Chronicle website. He took on the recent controversy around school textbooks in Texas with a column called Dear Texas, Shut Up, Sincerely History. Morford pitched a book of his writings.
And I encountered a lot of excitement for the book. Agents and publishers alike said, yes, this is a great idea, we like it.
But
they all said the same thing. They said this warning to me saying, the book deal, as you know it, is not what it used to be.
What it used to be was a nice fat advance and a paid-for tour to bookstores around the country with stays at swanky hotels.
That whole idea has sort of vanished, has sort of gone away. There is no more marketing money.
Morford began wondering if he should bother with a publishing house at all, especially since there's a burgeoning number of companies that will publish your book in print or any other format for a small price. He went with Bookmaster.
So they say, of course, we can do an ebook version, we can do a Kindle version, we can do the PDF. whatever the iPad format coming out is going to be, I can probably do that as well.
Morford's figuring he's got a core of fans and a column, so he can do his own marketing. He's hoping to follow in the footsteps of author Tim Chow. Chow couldn't be more different from Mark Morford. He's a geek. His recent book is called Cloud, and he's not talking about the white fluffy kind.
It's about a fundamental, I would say, the next fundamental shift in computing, much like...
Not exactly a page-turner for most people, but Chow gives talks and consults on the topic, and there's an audience for what he does. He could have tried to find a traditional publisher, but he did the math.
Let's take an arbitrary book that on the internet retails for $25, right? The author gets maybe $1 or $2 a book.
Chow found a self-publishing company called Lulu. They charge nothing up front and only print a book when someone buys one.
In the Lulu context, that same book, I'm going to get $10 to $12 per book.
Chow says he has sold nearly 10,000 copies of his book through Lulu. Do the math. That's six figures. He's the kind of author that the CEO of Lulu.com, Bob Young, imagined would profit from his company. Big companies can't make money on a few thousand copies, but Lulu can.
If the internet as a medium allows us to connect each of us with everyone else, why can't I, as an author, get my book to my audience without having to ask the permission of the publishing industry?
Lulu helps authors hook up with an editor, if they need it, and it offers design templates and marketing advice. Author Chow couldn't believe how simple it was.
In essence, if you can create a Word document, you can create a book. It's just about that simple.
Lulu books are available on e-readers like the Kindle, but now the iPad may grow the market for e-books by making them more appealing. iPad books will be in color and have interactive features like videos and links to related websites. If digital books really take off, Michael Schatzkin, who consults with publishers about digital books, thinks self-publishing is going to get a boost.
The biggest thing that a publisher provides is the ability to put physical copies of books on bookstore shelves. And as that becomes a less important component of the overall commercial proposition, the leverage that the publisher has or the reason that an author would have to go to a publisher is seriously diminished.
Self-publishing companies are even starting to draw established authors like John Edgar Wideman. He won the prestigious Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction twice and one of those MacArthur Genius Grants. Wideman's work deals with big, serious themes like race, class, alienation. Recently, Wideman published a collection of short stories on Lulu out of frustration with traditional publishers.
Cookbooks and serious novels get the same treatment, fighting for space in the chain stores. That works for some kinds of books, but I don't think it works for fiction.
Wideman says if this experiment works, he might try to publish an entire novel on Lulu. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
Presidio is a little city on the southern edge of West Texas. It's about 100 miles south of the nearest interstate, right on the Rio Grande. It's in a wild and beautiful part of Texas, and wild weather is part of the bargain. Presidio has only one link to the U.S. electrical grid. It comes from Marfa, 60 miles away. It was built in 1948, and that line goes down frequently. Presidio's solution is a battery worthy of the Lone Star State, a huge battery that can provide up to 8 hours of power for the entire town. It started charging up this week. Calvin Crowder is president of Electrical Transmission Texas. That's the outfit that is putting this whole battery thing together. He joins us. Welcome to the program, Mr. Crowder.
Thank you, Linda. I'm glad to be here.
Now, when you say that this big battery, did you name the battery? Does it have a name?
We did not name the battery. Some people call it Bob for big old battery, but we've not named it officially.
This thing can do 8 hours of power. Now, do you have to restrict it to just lights and refrigeration or something, or will it just run Presidio the way Presidio always runs?
For the most part, it will run it. The fact of the matter is Presidio has a total demand for electricity at its very peak period, the hottest hours of the hottest days of the year, of around 4,000 kilowatts or 4 megawatts. And the battery is simply charged and discharges into the transmission grid. It also has this capability of storing up to 4 megawatts of power for up to 8 hours.
What does 8 hours get you? What does it buy you?
Currently, and as you mentioned, we've got a single transmission line that was built over 60 years ago. And when we lose that line, we have no electrical connection to Presidio. What we have in place and what we've had for years is an agreement with the Mexican government that we can transfer the Presidio load over to Mexico. But that takes some time. And during that period of time, the townspeople don't have power.
So it just sort of gives you a bridging amount of power.
That's right. It's key for short period of time or bridging the power until we can find a long-term connection. It also has benefits of just being there in the area. Generators are needed near where electricity is consumed to provide what we call voltage support. And this ensures that the power quality is high and you don't have flickering of lights or resetting of VCRs.
Exactly. Quitting on you.
Exactly. And in Presidio, there is no such generation. And so this battery will also act as a source of what we call reactive power to improve power quality. So it'll have an ongoing role, and then it'll also serve this backup opportunity in the event of an outage.
Is it going to be a real test of big old battery when some summer lightning storm takes out the line and the battery kicks in and everybody in Presidio is dying from the heat and has their air conditioning on high? Is that going to be the moment when you find out whether Bob works or Bob doesn't?
That will be the test, and our success will be that nobody notices anything.
So is this just a special case, Mr. Crowder, a little town that's way away from sources of power? Or can you imagine that there might be other uses for batteries on this scale?
I think a little of both. It is a special case. The other solution for this town would be to build a second line, and that line would cost somewhere in the range of $40 to $50 million. And so a battery project in the $25 million range looks pretty attractive. What I believe we will do is be providing data and new knowledge of how these batteries operate so that those that do want to invest in batteries for purposes of wind power or solar storage can learn things and find out how to deploy even larger battery systems for their use.
Calvin Crowder is the president of Electric Transmission Texas. He joined us from the studios of KUT in Austin. Mr. Crowder, thanks very much.
Thank you, Linda. I appreciate the opportunity.
One part of the economy that seems to be doing fine is sales of just about anything labeled as the latest product from Apple. The iPad went on sale on Saturday. Apple's tablet computer is being hailed as a revolutionary device, but it may also bring a revolution to an end. NPR's Laura Seidel reports on how the iPad limits some of the freedom associated with the Internet.
On the Apple website, they make it seem as if holding the iPad is like a religious experience.
When you have a multi-touch display this large, you feel like you're actually holding the web right in the palm of your hand.
But that's not how Paul Sweeting sees it.
With the iPad, you have the anti-internet in your hands.
Sweeting is an analyst with GigaOm Network who has concerns about the way Apple controls everything on its device.
It's not an open platform where you can create a lot of content or other people can create a lot of applications and content that you can then access and use and incorporate into what you're doing.
The iPad is being marketed as an alternative to laptops and netbooks. But on most computers, you can put anything on it you want. The iPad is just like the iPhone. Every piece of software and every app must be approved by Apple. Jonathan Zittrain, a Harvard law professor, says with the iPhone, Apple has shown that it's willing to censor ideas it doesn't like. During the presidential election, Apple blocked a political app
called Freedom Time, and it actually just simply counted down the days, hours, minutes, and seconds until President Bush would be out of office, regardless of who his successor would be.
Zittrain worries that if the iPad really becomes popular for both entertainment and computing, other companies will imitate its closed system. Analyst Sweeting thinks many of the major media companies would love to see computers discourage people from searching the open web for content.
I think the media companies will leap at this because what it offers them is the opportunity to essentially recreate the old business model, wherein they are pushing content to you on their terms, rather than you going out and finding content or a search engine discovering content for you.
The iPad does have an internet browser, but it won't be possible to download unauthorized software or to view sites that use Flash, the technology that animates most visual content on the internet. But people waiting in line this weekend to buy an iPad didn't seem bothered by Apple's restrictions. In fact, many, like Damon Brown, prefer it.
When you have the more open systems, there's more of a risk of there being less quality control and a lot of garbage apps.
And it isn't like there's a shortage of apps. The iPhone has more than 100,000 available, and there are already more than 1,000 just for the iPad. Jennifer Childers likes Apple's gatekeeping.
It's not being controlled so much because every idea has gotten through except for things that are like pornography or some other things that I wouldn't be looking at anyway.
There is one big competitor that's likely to try and create a device that will offer up major competition to Apple's iPad, Google. The search giant profits from an open environment, but its Nexus One Android phone hasn't been as appealing to consumers as Apple's iPhone. Analyst Sweeting says Apple's limitations make its products feel safer.
Apple is offering you a gated community where there's a guard at the gate and there's probably maid service too.
As more consumers have fears about security on the internet, viruses and malware, they may be happy to opt for Apple's gated community. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
Over the next few days on Morning Edition, we're going to be looking at America's cybersecurity. It's about safeguarding everything that happens over computer networks, from online banking to the power grid to cell phones. Even the security of military operations is at stake here. When you count all of that, no country on this planet depends so much on computer networks, and that means no country is as vulnerable to disruptions. NPR's Tom Gelton will be our guide through these challenges. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Steve.
I assume you're here to tell us that we're not all that secure.
Afraid not, Steve. You know, we have had cyber criminals, cyber mischief makers, cyber spies, as long as there's been an internet, and we have built up defenses against them. But what's new is the sophistication of cyber attacks is now outpacing the sophistication of cyber defense. It's a sophistication gap. That's what's jeopardizing our cybersecurity.
This is the same kind of thing you have in any kind of warfare. The offense is ahead, then the defense catches up. Should we be concerned about our own security as individuals or about the security of the nation here?
Well, as individuals, we have to be on guard against cybercrime of all kinds. But I'm going to focus on the national security issues. Remember, each year, the Director of National Intelligence delivers an official threat assessment. It used to be terrorism always topped the list. Then last year, the new director, Dennis Blair, surprised everyone by saying the global financial meltdown was the biggest security threat. This year, he started with cyber.
Malicious cyber activity is growing at an unprecedented rate.
Malicious cyber activity. He's talking about the whole range of things cyber attackers do and saying we're actually losing ground in our efforts to deal with them.
Just the facts of the matter are that cyber defenders have to spend more, have to work harder than cyber attackers. And American efforts are not strong enough in this regard right now.
Thousands of cyber attacks every single day. A big one in 2007 targeted the Pentagon, NASA, and other government agencies. U.S. officials suspect China was behind it. Jim Lewis of the Center for Strategic and International Studies says it was like the hackers went in with a vacuum cleaner, sucking up all the stuff within reach, some of it important, some of it worthless.
In fact, I felt sorry because some guy over probably in Beijing is having to sit there and translate state dinner menus from, 1994, and he's probably going nuts.
Lewis directed the Commission on Cybersecurity for the 44th presidency. He's someone we'll hear a lot from in this series. There was also a big cyber attack in 2003. Big enough, the FBI actually gave it a code name, Titan Rain. Richard Clark knows about that one. He was a White House advisor on various security issues, including cyber, for Presidents Clinton and Bush. Clark says the Titan Rain hackers penetrated several military networks without being detected.
There's still some debate about who did it and why they did it. But what it proved was that it is possible to get into even well-defended networks and exfiltrate terabytes of information, and nothing can be done about it.
terabytes is a lot. If all the words in all the books in the Library of Congress were converted to data, that would be about 10 terabytes. And that's about how much was taken in Titan Rain and also in 2007. And there will be more. Hackers in other countries can take control of a bunch of people's personal computers in the U.S. and command them all remotely to send out bogus emails or viruses. Thousands of robot computers networked and at a hacker's disposal. You call it a botnet. Harry Radaghi, a retired Air Force lieutenant general who's worked on cyber issues much of his career, says it starts with individual users who don't have antivirus software on their home computers.
People who have computers and they have no protection are susceptible to being captured unknown to them and then being part of a botnet army that is used to attack an organization, a nation, or an industry.
Botnets have been around for a while, but hackers and foreign governments are using them in more damaging ways. We're seeing a move from cybercrime to cyber espionage. As in the case of the hackers who stole secrets from Google in China last December. And Richard Clark says the stage is now set for a full-scale cyber attack.
The difference between cybercrime, cyber espionage, and cyber war is a couple of keystrokes. The same technique that gets you in to steal money, the same technique that gets you in to steal patented blueprint information or chemical formulas, that's the same technique that a nation state would use to get in and destroy things.
The big U.S. fear is that in a cyber war, an adversary could take down our power grid, our telephone network, or our transportation system. Jim Lewis takes the threat seriously.
My guess is that right now it's only a few advanced militaries that could damage the electrical grid or damage some other networks. But they have that capability. They've probably done the reconnaissance necessary to use it. And if we got into a fight, we could expect some kind of cyber attack.
I then asked Lewis if the U.S. is capable of defending itself. He smiled.
I didn't realize we had defensive capabilities. No, that's not fair. How can I say that?
Retired General Harry Radaghi now works at the consulting firm Deloitte, but he still follows cyber issues closely, and he says it's not fair to say we have no cyber defenses. He cites the 2007 attack on the Pentagon when Defense Secretary Robert Gates and others had their Pentagon email accounts hacked.
When the secretary was attacked, of course, someone got in, but somebody also noticed it right away, was able to isolate those attackers, clean up the system, and then put the users back online immediately. It's a real battle space.
In fact, cyber experts say U.S. military and intelligence networks are now moderately well defended, but that still leaves the non-military government networks, and Jim Lewis says they have a mixed record at best when it comes to cybersecurity efforts.
Some places, Treasury, a relatively good job. Other places, the other agencies, relatively dreadful job, right? They may as well just change their passwords to welcome Chinese friends.
And those are just the government networks. The power, telecommunication, and transportation grids are largely in private hands, meaning the U.S. military can't really protect them. A new military cyber command has been organized, and the Obama administration has designated a cyber czar to coordinate cybersecurity policy. But Richard Clark says we have a ways to go.
Right now, the government is saying Cyber Command will defend the military and the intelligence community. Homeland Security Department will defend the rest of the federal government. And the rest of us are on our own.
And Steve, those power and telecom companies, essentially, they're on their own.
That's NPR's Tom Gelton reporting on cybersecurity or the lack of it. And Tom, I want to ask, because other kinds of war, like nuclear war, seem to have been prevented through deterrence, the threat of a counterattack. Does deterrence work with cyber war?
Steve, U.S. officials are still trying to come up with a deterrence strategy for cyber war. It's a problem. We're going to be getting to that scenario tomorrow.
NPR's Tom Gelton, thanks very much. Now, if you want a list of some of the most serious cyber attacks we have already faced in recent years, go to npr.org.